but he knew that it would take more than half an hour for any reply for him to reach the moon. Besides, it wouldn't be wise to be so disrespectful to the man who pays all the bills. So he wiped Grigor's image from his wall screen and replied merely, "Message received. Will comply." 5 ships. Grigor thinks that more ships will guarantee success. He has no idea of how difficult it is to coordinate a multi-ship attack out here. The more ships we use, the sooner the prey will realize it's being tracked. Harbin shook his head in mild disgust. I could do it alone. One ship with a crew of one. Give me the coordinates of the astro vessel's course and I'll intercept it and terminate it. And if Fuchs is in the area, I'll handle him too. Leaning back in his padded chair, Harbin locked his fingers behind his head and thought it over. Fuchs is smart, though. Wily, like a badger. He can sniff out danger 1,000 kilometers away. 5 ships might make sense. Maybe a few more to go out ahead of me and take up stations that will cut off his line of retreat. Then I'd have him, finally.
He sat up straight, nodded once at the blank wall screen, then got to his feet and headed for the command center. He needed the latest tracking data on the astro vessel.
Big George was staring at a wall screen, too. Pancho sat beside him in his informal office, her eyes glued to the grainy image of Lars Fuchs. "I received Pancho's message," Fuchs said, his broad, jowly face downcast, sour-looking. "Unfortunately, I can't risk a meeting. Too many of Humphrey's spies might learn of it. Whatever you have to tell me, Pancho, send it in a message." The image winked off. Pancho blinked, then turned to George. "That's it? That's his whole message?" "He doesn't waste words," George replied. "Afraid somebody might intercept the beam and get a fix on his location." "I've got to talk to him," Pancho said, feeling frustrated. "Face to face." George said, "Lots of luck." Getting to her feet, Pancho said, "I can't tell him Mandy's dead over a comlink." Shaking his unshorn head, George replied, "He's not going to meet with you, Pancho. I didn't think he would." "I'm not going to lead him into a trap, for crap's sakes." "Not knowingly." She frowned at him. "Lars hasn't survived out there for so long being naive," George said. "Humphreys has had mercenaries trying to bag him. Freelancers, too. The word's gone round the belt that Humphreys will pay a bounty for Lars's head." Pancho grimaced. "Mandy told me he promised to leave Lars alone." "Sure he did," George replied, scorn dripping from each syllable. "I've got to see him." "It's not going to happen, Pancho. Face it. Lars is cautious, and I can't say I blame him." Pancho took a deep breath, telling herself, "When you're faced with a stone wall, find a way around it, or over it, or tunnel under it if you have to. What did Dan Randolph always say? When the going gets tough, the tough get going, to where the going's easier." "George," she asked, sitting down next to him again, "how do you get messages to Lars?" He hesitated a moment, then, "He's got half a dozen or so miniaturized transceivers scattered around on minor asteroids out there. When I squirt a message to one of them, I can tell him which one I'll be aiming at on the next message." "And the transceivers stay on the same roids all the time?" "Nah. Lars moves them around. He tells me where they'll be next when he answers me back." Pancho was silent for a few moments, thinking. At last she said, "So you could send him a message and tell him where you'll be sending the next one." "And when?" George added. "And then he goes to that rock to pick up your message." "Right." "I could be waiting for him at the asteroid where the transceiver is. When Lars shows up, I'll be there to greet him." George huffed. "And he'll blow you to bits before you can say hello." "Not if count on it," George said. I'll take that chance. Shaking his head, George replied, Pancho, I can't give you the fucking coordinates. Lars will think I betrayed him for crying out loud. I've got to see Lars face to face. I'm willing to take the chance that he'll attack my ship. It's on my head. George remained adamant for hours. Pancho wheedled, pleaded, begged. What's so fucking important? George asked. What is it that you've got to tell him to his face? Pancho hesitated for a fraction of a second. Then she answered, George, if I could tell you, I would. But it's for Lars's ears only. He scratched at his thick beard. That vague, huh? Pancho nodded wordlessly. All right, he said uneasily. Tell you what I'll do. I'll go out on the ship with you. But you said it'd be dangerous. Yeah, and it will be, believe it. But I think I can work out a scheme that'll keep Lars from blasting us on sight. Besides, I'd rather be there to face him than have him think I ratted him out.
Torch shipped Samarkand. Harbin sat in Samarkand's command chair, his pilot and navigator seated on a level of the bridge slightly below his. The data screens showed a confusing array of ship trajectories heading toward Ceres and away from the asteroid. The ship's computer was sorting out all the information, seeking the one ship that carried Pancho Lane. She's too clever to use her own vessel, Harbin thought, as one by one the curving lines indicating individual ships' courses winked out. She'll hitch a ride aboard some prospector ship, or maybe an astrologistics vessel. The tracking information came straight from the IAA controllers in the Chrysalis habitat orbiting Ceres. Harbin wished that Humphreys had enough spies aboard the habitat to watch Pancho Lane and see which vessel she entered, but that kind of information was not available to him. So he dispatched three armed ships out into the belt and kept three more in a very loose formation centered on his own vessel. To an untrained eye, it looked like a few more prospector's ships heading outward. Harbin hoped that's what Fuchs would see. The welter of curving lines slowly diminished on the screen until only one ship's planned trajectory was displayed. Harbin shook his head, muttering, "Stupid computer." The ship's manifest said it belonged to the government of Ceres and carried none other than their chief administrator, who was going out on an inspection tour of various mining operations in the belt. The chief rock rat going to visit his little rock rat brethren, Harbin thought. Then his eyes narrowed. Why is their chief administrator traipsing through the belt? Has he ever done that before? He asked the computer. The answer returned almost before he finished uttering the question. Never. This was the first inspection tour on record. Harbin smiled grimly. Maybe the computer isn't so stupid after all. He sent a message to Grigor, all the way back at Salini. Do you have any way of finding out who's on the torch ship Matilda II with the Rockrat's chief administrator? Grigor replied in little more than an hour. No passenger list is available. Apparently the vessel carries only its crew of three and the man Ambrose. Harbin nodded and remembered that Pancho Lane had once been a professional astronaut. She could probably take the place of a crewman on Ambrose's ship. To his own navigator he commanded, Set a course to follow the vessel shown on the computer display. Stay well behind it. I don't want them to know we're following them.
Matilda, too, was a great deal more comfortable than the original waltzing Matilda. That old bucket had been a mining ship before it was shot to shreds in the first asteroid war. Matilda, too, was a comfortably fitted torch ship capable of carrying important passengers while serving as a mobile office for the chief administrator of the Ceres settlement. Sitting in a swivel chair in the galley, George was explaining, I left a message for Lars and told him where we'll be waiting for him. This way, we don't surprise him. Pancho was seated across the galley table from George. They were in the middle of dinner, Pancho picking at a salad, while George wholeheartedly